Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
Until the punch bowl is taken away, which we're probably going to start doing that within the bond market, they're not going to rein in this fiscal foolishness. So we're going to demand higher yields and higher return on our money to help protect us against that loss of purchasing power, which is going to be dramatic the longer you go out on the curve.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Finance U. I am your host, Chris Martinson, back here again with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Paul, good to see you back this week.
Good to see you again as well, Chris.
All right. Hey, you know where I want to start today, Paul? How about this? Have you been watching bonds?
Oh, very closely. Very, very closely.
Yeah. And so you and I have been watching this for a little while. We've been talking about, say, the Japanese bonds. We've been talking about where they've been going. But this has now finally caught the larger popular imagination and attention. And we know that because just yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, they finally caught on to this. And they said, they caught on quick, the global bond rout is accelerating. Here's what, that doesn't sound very good, global bond rout. We're going to have to talk about this because this is actually a really big deal. So they say here, quote, a weeks-long sell-off in government bonds has intensified in recent days, threatening to drive up borrowing costs across the globe and knocking some momentum out of what had been a furious stock rally. With bond prices sliding, the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note, a key benchmark for everything, including mortgage rates and other borrowing costs, reached as high as 4.687% Tuesday, highest level intraday since January 2025, but the yield on the 30-year climbed to a new 18-year high, near 5.2%. We're going to have to talk about this, Paul, because this is a pretty big deal. So, and we'll get to some more data in just a second, but it's not just the U.S. This is kind of a Western phenomenon, including throwing Japan in the West. Bond markets are sliding, which means yields are going up, which means prices are going down, which means that the buyers of bonds are not buying as much as selling anymore. And so people don't want to hold bonds. Now, Wall Street Journal very helpfully says, oh, it's possibly related to uncertainty around the war. I'm like, no, it's possibly related to massive inflation. I got the data, but what are you seeing?
No, I'm with you. I mean, look, here's the thing. Why in the world, if the government's going to keep spending fiscally foolishly, they're going to, you know, just bar us into oblivion, all this data center debt and everything that's going in there. If they're basically going to bail us out in every circumstance going forward, why in the world do you want to tie your money up in 20, 30-year treasuries, especially in the context of history and the rates that were coming out of the 1970s inflation that we had? And I'm concerned this one's going to be even worse. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the bond investors, being the smartest ones in the room, seem to have finally come to the conclusion, hey, you know, this is a path that we're headed down. And until the punch bowl is taken away, which we're probably going to start doing that within the bond market, they're not going to rein in this fiscal foolishness. So we're going to demand higher yields and higher return on our money to help protect us against that loss of purchasing power, which is going to be dramatic the longer you go out on the curve.
Yeah, and we'll get back to the 70s double hump inflation, which is a theme we've been on for months here. And I think now it's pretty obvious that's what's going to happen. Back in the 70s, they called bonds, U.S. Treasury bonds, certificates of confiscation, right? Mm-hmm. which sort of meant like, hey, if I'm holding even a 10% bond, but inflation is 14%, my money is being confiscated by inflation, which again is actually an act of monetary and fiscal policy. Inflation is not some mysterious omen from nature that nobody understands where it comes from, right? It's a policy. So when the government policy is to run high inflation, but then try and issue its bonds at less than the rate of inflation, well, sometimes you get that buyer strike, which I think we're right at the beginning stages of here.
It appears that way. I mean, look, the Eastern countries, China's been reducing their exposure to U.S. bonds. Russia had done it quite some time ago. The argument has to do with protection against sanctions. I think they just saw the handwriting on the wall and the weakness of our leaders at this point and the unwillingness to go through the pain that's inevitably still coming. And now U.S. investors that have been drinking the Kool-Aid are starting to realize, hey, you know, we're in trouble here if we don't make some changes.
Well, absolutely. So here's some of the data. This is a chart of the U.S. 10-year yield. You can see here, this is it's kind of tricky to read on a small screen, I bet. This is 2026, so this would be January. This is February. Here's March, right at the start of the war. It kicks off, it hit a low here of about 3.95%, immediately vaulted up to 4.4. A lot of fighting around that 4.4 level, then vaulted up here to about 4.65. It's fallen back a little bit today, but you can clearly see the trend here is that's the 10-year and then the 30-year. Bull Theory here on X had a pretty interesting observation saying that the last time the U.S. 30-year bond yield was this high, the stock market peaked 3 months later. So there could be a connection there. And highest level since July 2007. But this time, U.S. has $39 trillion in debt. Part of the reason, which they didn't really go into in depth in the Wall Street Journal article, is that CPI is at 3.8%, PPI at 6%. I presented some of that data last week. I got some more here. We got to talk about this. Inflation is back on the rise, obviously, and so bonds selling off. Must be tricky from your position, though, because I know you run lots of different scenarios for people in their retirement, and you talk specifically about, hey, hate to do this, hate to be that guy, but we're going to have to sort of run your retirement plans under various different inflation scenarios and sort of gut check, you know, how do they perform?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, people are finally starting to understand why now we've been running 5.5% compounded inflation and, you know, 3.5%, you know, people are like, well, I'm not worried about 5.5%. Now, your followers and listeners are actually more concerned about that. But the consistent gasp that I get on the other side of, oh, my goodness, because you break it down and show this is in your retirement. You're going to spend $3.5 million. You need total $3.5 million of income or whatever, $6 million, whatever that number is, depending upon the person. But if you do it at 5.5, it's twice that number. And people are like, oh, my goodness. And, you know, and of course, I make the comment kind of leading a little bit that if the average individual really understood this over a long term period of time, we would have a mass revolt against our government leaders in the policies that they have instituted, because people are going, hey, my asset prices are going up. That's great. But they don't understand that what's following is going to be an absolute erosion of their purchasing power in retirement. And the picture that they have in the future, if this continues, if they're unprepared for it, it's going to be completely different than the advertisements that they have in, oh, you're just going to have a great retirement. You're going to be all smiles and sunshine and rainbows the whole time. Inflation is a terrible evil. And in addition to that, like, the long-term picture that I want to share here is if you go back and look at the trend that we had in 30-year treasuries, the chart that I'm sharing is the 30-year treasury going back to 1977. So we had that spike, right, that double hump inflation that came through, and we peaked up here. I got to move a few things around 15% on the treasury. And then it started working its way down. You have this nice established negative trend that's in place. Right. So every time you get close to it, you fail and rates go lower and they go lower. And then all of a sudden in 2022, you break that trend. And that wasn't just a little breach. I mean, this is a regime change that we're in right now. Mm-hmm. Now, technically, you can't see it, but we are above, and this is a monthly chart, we'll have to finish at it, but we're above this resistance line that goes all the way back to 2003. So that's a 24 approximately year resistance zone where it tried to peak above and then it collapsed down a little bit further in 2008. And, you know, and we're in a completely different situation than we were in 2003, 2004, right? Home prices were not in a bubble. That happened in 2006, 7, and 8. You went through a stock market that had a decline from 2000-2003. The NASDAQ bubble burst. But here we are now, and the government is still continuing to print fiscally f- foolishly spend and try to stimulate the economy when we've got inflationary pressures that are continuing to build. We break out of this range, it's going to be very similar. We solidly break out of here. It's going to be very similar to the breakout that we showed in gold, what, 2-3 years ago. It was a major break of resistance. And I believe that's coming. I mean, it's just the weight of the information tells us that's where we are. But look how big of a trend this is in place. This is a completely new regime. But the markets are assuming that we're going to get this type of asset inflation going forward because they don't realize how big of an impact lower rates have been on people's ability to borrow money and lever up.
Well, so, and on that point, you know, Paul, I kind of had to school a boomer because I was in this public discussion nearby in town, and they were like, you know, they own all some properties, a lot of rentals in town. They're like, I don't understand why the kids, they just, you know, you just buy a house, you fix it up, and it makes you money. I'm like, they had that tailwind, that long downward slope. That was a great time to do exactly that strategy, but that's not the world we're in anymore. And so it's just really hard to change your mindset when it's all been raised and schooled and conditioned for a certain environment, right? So everything, houses, stocks, all keyed off of the fact that yields were going down the whole time. That made those other two assets go up. Well, now those yields have reversed. Housing is already starting to take it in a variety of communities. We're seeing a lot of places where, obviously, the housing got super unaffordable, but it's also really starting to suffer. Stocks are the last man standing in this, but remember, old Wall Street saying, stocks are for show, but bonds are for
dough.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The show might be winding up here if bond yields keep doing what they're doing. That's why I wanted to lead off with this. This is the most important thing happening in the financial space right now, is all this creaking and popping and bursting of the bond yields.
And Chris, going back to housing and talking about what the boomers experienced in the early 80s, their purchasing power, they had more purchasing power, the income that they earned. I wish I knew where I had some data to bring that up right now, but that we'll save that for a little bit later. But here's an example. I mean, back in the early 1990s, I remember my uncle would sit down. He's buying rental properties. And his thing was I'll build one a year, and then I'll buy one a year. So that's what he did for a certain period of time working forward. So his formula was, because it was a completely different environment back then, if you can buy a property and it'll pay for it, so the rent will pay for it in 7 years, right? Then borrow some money, put it to work. But, you know, when he originally started buying, you're borrowing money at 12 and 14%. And then it gets down to 6 or 7%, and you can refinance. And he was the type of person that would just pour all that extra cash flow back into paying it off. But the rule of thumb was, if you can buy a property and it'll pay for itself from the rent in 7 years, you're good, you know, because you've got vacancies, you've got repairs, you've got people that are going to mess things up. Then it got up to 10 or it got up to 12 years, and 12 years was his threshold. I mean, I can't tell you how many people come in. The only reason that they're going to buy rental properties is because that's what their parents did and it worked. That's what their uncles did and it worked. And the argument from that whole generation is, hey, I've never bought a piece of property that didn't work out if I held it long enough. But the problem is, I had somebody just 2 weeks ago was like, hey, I think I got a really good deal. These people are willing to sell it for 15% less than what the asking price is. So we looked at rentals. We looked at insurance. We looked at their total cost, the leverage carrying. You're talking about 25 to 30 years before it'll cash flow to pay that note off. And I looked at the client and I'm like, okay, so let's just talk, get rid of your preconceived ideas, right? What happens if you have 20% vacancy? Okay, let's just say if it's 10%. Let's say if it's 5%. You know, 30-year roofs last 15 years now. They don't make anything as good as what they used to. Any pressure-treated porches are going to have to be replaced in about 7 or 8 years because we've got these built, you know, supposedly good for the environment. I grew up handling pressure-treated lumber, and I don't know anybody that got in trouble from it, but that stuff used to last 30 years. And the mathematics are, you're talking about 35, 40 years before you get, you know, a real return on your money, and you just don't have that long. So we're in a completely different environment. And if rates continue to go up, there's no bailing out, right? You're stuck. If you get in a bind, you can't refinance, get a lower rate, wrap up that foolish credit card debt in the house and still be okay, because rates are going to go up and you're stuck. It's a completely different environment.
And I've been hearing some horror stories, particularly from Georgia, because y'all have a really crazy insurance commission or something. But insurance, horrible. Insurance is now doubling on people, house insurance. So you look at all those input costs, right? What's it going to cost to maintain this property? I'm going to have to insure it. All of these costs are just going up. And if you ever did any of this on a variable rate mortgage, right? Oops, you know. So I could see this really turning against a lot of people pretty badly if you don't, like, you know. I mean, think of the headache too, right? Owning a house, right? And you're renting it. Somebody's got to field that call at 2 a.m. when the hot water goes out, right? Or whatever. Like, it's everybody who's in it tells me it's full contact sport. You know, best only live a couple miles from all your rentals because you'll be driving a lot, right? Okay, that's the deal. Or you're going to spend another 10-15% of the rental fee on a management company and, you know, hope for the best. All right. There are a lot of other ways you can earn a return where you're going to basically, you know, your money's going to double over 25, 30 years, right? Effectively.
Mm-hmm.
That don't require that much work.
That's right.
And
that's
headache.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. And you're right. The best way to explain it is a full contact sport. So, you know, and not only do you have to deal with the maintenance, you have to deal with the psychology. So I had a client one time went in and bought a lower end rental neighborhood, and he shows up and, you know, to collect rent first of the month. And this young lady comes up, she's got a black eye, holding a screaming baby, right? And horrible situation. But he, in good conscience, could not. She's like, my husband beat me and ran, and I don't have the rent. So he lets her go that month. Well, the next month, out of the 10 houses, they had two other of the same stories. And he's like, I can't do this. I'm out, right? And then, you know, he didn't have anybody that could show up and do that rent. So there's all kinds of things that people have to deal with. They think that it's going to be easy, and it's not. It's a lot of work. And the problem of where we are right now is it's priced to perfection. You're technically in a bubble based on people's ability to purchase and their spending power. I mean, look, what are the statistics? The large majority of homes are purchased or individuals over the age of 55, right? So the younger generation isn't able to get in there and purchase. It's just a terrible situation across the board. And look, I'd buy a property all day long if I could buy it and the current rent would pay for that property in 7 years. That mathematics is worth the challenge over the long term and the work that goes into it. But your margin for error is so minimal. I mean, if you're talking 25, 30 years on that rent to be able to pay for the purchase of that property, you might get good cash flow on it, but you're not going to make the type of return that you expected. And here's another example. You talk about in Georgia how insurance is. So I've had two clients that have called in the past month that have had to take lump sums out. Luckily, I had planned for it. They didn't realize that I had. But their insurance company is refusing to renew their insurance because their roofs are in the 22 to 24 year range, and they're 40 year roofs, and they'll probably last another 7 or 8 years. But they're like, no, we're not going to renew it unless you replace that roof.
What?
So, yeah, I didn't even know they could do that. But this is
me
what the
neither.
Clients are telling me, right? So I've still got to call my insurance agent and ask if that's possible. But that's the power that these insurance companies have. They're like, look, you put a new roof on that because if you've got an older roof and you have a hailstorm, it's going to damage easier than a newer roof. So they're trying to protect themselves at your expense. And that's something that can come out of the blue. So,
wow.
You know, that's the things that we are starting to see. And that's my frustration because Georgia used to have a great insurance commissioner. Unfortunately, ended his career with a couple of DUIs, but the legacy that he left in place for a while was phenomenally for the benefit of the consumer. But just like everything else in the halls of power, corporate capture has taken them over. And now they're maximizing profit for private equity and for their corporate interests. And they just see us as a bunch of cattle that they can pass on their poor investments to and give every excuse in the world for the politicians who are dumb as a box of rocks as far as their depth of thinking. And these little bitty headlines leads them to believe, oh, yeah, you got to do that. You got to raise rates, right? So it's just a terrible environment for the consumer right now, and it's going to have to swing in the other direction at some point.
It's bad. And by the way, that's not reflected in our so-called CPI. They just capture that. In fact, according to the CPI, health insurance has gone down by 0.5% over the last 6 years. Like, it's actually gone down. All right. Like... So speaking of shocking things that show up quickly on your doorstep, very quickly, this is Japan's bond markets breaking here. The 30-year bond yield, absolute all-time high, never been higher. Even during the 2008 crisis, the 30-year yield was twice lower. So this is pretty astonishing. And so they're 30-year, you know, cranking out here at 4.25 maybe, something like that. So, Paul, the carry trade we talked about, it used to be that people would borrow in Japan at cheap rates and then carry that money elsewhere and earn a higher rate. But this is going to change that flow of capital to and fro from Japan, and it's across their entire term structure here. This is 10, 20, 30, 40-year bonds, all of them spiking up since 2021. This isn't just a wartime, you know, thing. This is a structural shift. Again, these things have been trending down for years, like you said. They broke out. This is sort of a little presage, a little preview into what I think you're going to see in the U.S. if our breakout follows the Japanese breakout. Higher for longer, and that's going to upset all kinds of things out there. By the way, just to complete it, look at the yields in the UK. These people are in deep trouble. I think the UK is going to have a pretty nasty fiscal crisis here coming up. So they're nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. I didn't show you, but the rest of Europe is also, you know, spiking. This is a collective global, at least Western, sovereign debt problem that we're facing right now. Which will rapidly lead to fiscal crises and potentially monetary crises if it isn't checked. But what could check this? What would cause violent upward charts like this and this to reverse?
Well, really the only thing that can put that in check is if we have a violent equity market sell-off. I mean, really, that's the only thing. The bond market breaks out to the point. Lou Groman's most recent tree rings came out with a kind of a good explanation. He's like, our base case is they're just going to print, right? But at least until we have a market fit, they're not going to openly do so. Because what's going to happen is if the equity market gets the wind taken out of its sails at some point here in the next 12 to 24 months, that's going to shake these investors who think that it's different this time and have fully convinced themselves, and that's going to force some rebalancing within these mechanical models. That's going to, you know, pull some funds back over into the bond market because it's just supply and demand. I mean, you look at the numbers right now; people are selling value stocks, they're selling everything to chase these top leaders of momentum in the markets. They're levering themselves to the hilt across the board. And when the bond market, you know, the smarter investors in the room say, look, I'm just not going to deploy capital there. The risk is too high. I think that's when you have a market calamity, which my concern on the other side of it, because I'm still of the belief that at least at some point we get some deflationary pressures before they have, you know, before they openly just print like crazy. And then on the other side of that, you see the markets take off and the inflationary holocaust comes, but that big sell-off allows these big institutions that are caught on the wrong side of these bond yields right now to liquidate their positions to the average investor who went from euphoric over the markets to absolutely scared to death and lowering their risk back into those bonds at kind of the worst time on the other side. That's just kind of my working theory of how this is going to pan out.
The other reason for all of this, of course, is simply that inflation is really pretty bad. And so the PPI inflation, the last reading we had, is about a 6% reading. It's actually a lot worse than that on an annualized basis. I got the data here in just a second, but it's clearly been sneaking up. And this, by the way, has been sneaking up since long before the war. The war obviously has put some rocket fuel on this, but you can see it bottomed out here at below 1% back in mid-2023. It's sort of been bouncing along, but the trend is clearly up. Until this happens, and again, this actually starts, really kicks off in January. The war is actually this tick right here. So it already had some tailwinds to it, right? It was floating upwards for a variety of reasons. And then we're recording this on the 20th of May, but Mohammed El-Erian on the 13th, recording the most recent PPI reading, has had a huge jump in the U.S. Producer Price Index inflation powered by an eye-popping 1.4% rise in April. So, Paul, if we annualize that out, it's not just 12 times 1.4, it's 1.4 compounded 12 times. That's like 17%, just on top of my head, somewhere in that zone. I can't do the math that quickly. Nearly triple the 0.5% consensus. So what were those economists smoking? I guess they weren't watching the war. I don't know what they were up to, right? And then, of course, he says here on May 15th, bond yields taking a hit too because hotter than expected Japanese PPI. And then in the UK, their April PPI came also in at 1.4% versus 0.9% previous estimated 1%. So PPI, Producer Price Index, is running hotter than expected globally. And by the way, if you want to know where CPI is going to be, all you have to do is take PPI today, and in 2 months, that's where it's going to be, typically, for lots of reasons. So inflation is running hot. Should not be a surprise, because we've all been watching this war unfold. Sulfur, this weird element from the periodic table, turns out to be really important. It was ignored even by myself, and I'm a big commodities guy because it was just this ignorable. It was like 700 a ton, 1,000 a ton, something like that. It was just a byproduct of oil refining from sour crude.
So where's the sulfur going? Because that's not actually been on my radar. What's it used for, and is it shortages out of the Middle East war that's causing it?
Yeah. So about half the world's sulfur is now offline. But most importantly, it's sulfuric acid. And sulfuric acid is used for everything in mining, all kinds of mining processes. It's used in making computer chips, right? It's basically the input for an innumerable number of industrial supplies. So as this goes up, this is the equivalent as when oil goes up, because it's an input feedstock very early in the supply chain. So, gosh, it's going to cost me this much more to mine copper. I guess I'm going to have to charge this much more for copper. It costs me this much more to produce any of these various products that I produce. I have to sort of pad that into the downstream cost, and off they go. But that's pretty astonishing, a 7Xer.
Commodities are just now breaking out. They've not even started gaining momentum yet. So this is just the early stages
of
that trend change.
Early. That's a big, you spin the wheel on the oil tanker, and a month later, the nose starts to swing about. Look at this. Packaged foods. So this is input costs for packaged foods. This comes out of Financial Times. The Daily Shot posted this on X. Spot price average cost inflation for packaged food and beverage companies, 7.9% in that month.
Wow. And look at the prices of foods and anything that's packaged from that standpoint and how much they're up already with those smaller numbers. And this is just another cost push surge that's going to be building into the pipeline, higher prices.
So sulfur, packaging, do you ever have to truck things to get them to market? So truckloads, spot rates continue to surge. Now $3.61 a mile on the daily chart, within 6 cents per mile of breaking an all-time record set back here in 2021-22 when we had the highest inflation, the Biden inflation, topping out about almost 9%, right? So we're back to that. So sulfur, packaging, trucking. Paul, we're talking very, very basic at the head of the Nile, early input costs that are going to just start feeding downstream. And the bearded Miguel here says this is only the inflation the BLS concedes, which we all know is bogus because they massage the numbers to keep them as low as possible. So this is only the inflation the BLS concedes, and we all know it's higher. And for 10 years, it has now increased at 335 basis points, 3.35% per annum. The most since Q1 1998. So this is 10-year annualized. So it's given you a good long read. So this goes all the way back to 1998. But look, it's just been just excrement. So this 1998 was long-term capital management. That's where the Fed really began its print-a-thon program. Problem, print. Problem, print. Problem, print. So that's where we are. And that's astonishing to me. That's a very long-term thing. Prediction. It's about to vault a lot higher. Charlie Bilello pointing out that price increases since the start of the Iran war, which was just obviously February 28th, March 1st, depending on your time zone. Let's call it March 1st. Fertilizer, 20%. Urea, a form of fertilizer, 28%. Crude oil, 50%. Diesel, 51%, et cetera. So these are really high double-digit increases, and every single one of these things is an input feed cost at the head of the production chain.
Mm-hmm.
That's where that's going.
That's a big deal.
That's why you don't want to own any of the certificates of confiscation. That's why smart money is walking away from the bonds as quickly as they can. And they, you know, yes. There's only so fast you can do that without dumping the market, right? But
that's right. That's right. And look, you know, there's so little money going into inflation protected bonds right now. It's clear. Sometimes we're a little slow on that trend change, right? When you see it come, but we've recently repositioned our fixed income portfolios relatively dramatically to have short and intermediate term inflation protected securities, because now you've got this trend established and you have some clear layout that this is going to be there for a while. And so, you know, stay, you know, I'm not a believer that you go way out on that yield curve, because there's just way too much risk on it right now. So the best way to explain it, I think this statistic's still true. At least it used to be true about 10 years ago. There were actually more lawsuits against investment advisors, stockbrokers, and whatever over bonds than there were stocks, because most people really don't understand how they work. But if you've got a short, if you've got a shorter term maturity, let's say it's 2 years, think of a really short seesaw on the playground, right? So it moves minimally. If you go out 30 years, then that's a dramatic move, you know, just in 2% interest rates. I can't remember the numbers now, but it's dramatically lower on the low side. And yeah, you're going to have that steady income over that period of time. But what happens if you're locked in at 30 years at 5%? And 5 years from now, rates are 15 or 17%, and your principal is 50% lower. So if you're in a position where you're forced to sell it, you're screwed. I'm just going to say it. I'm sorry. I was trying to find another term. It just didn't come to mind. And so, but you're stuck. I mean, you've missed that opportunity to be shorter in duration and have some flexibility to protect yourself against inflation, to where at least you can take advantage of that if we get there and then assess the situation and maybe lock those rates in for longer. So I'm not a big believer that you should be out on the yield curve right now, specifically maybe for a trade, which is not looking very good right now. And specifically not from a long-term modern portfolio theory. I'm going to take 30% of my portfolio and put it in 20, 30-year bonds, because the weight of the evidence tells you right now that's going to be a massive loss on your portfolio, and you're giving up a huge amount of income in the future when inflation looks to be really high, when you're going to need that inflation-adjusted income the most.
We've talked about this chart before, but it's been updated to just finish this up. The Informationist, that's James Lavish. He does some good work. So we put out this chart before. I think the first instantiation of it was Torsten Slocks from Apollo. But when we did it before, Paul, the green line was here.
Mm-hmm.
Now look at this with the most recent PPI reading through April, right? We are now perfectly. So what we're looking at, people, here is a chart that goes, it has two things across the bottom axis. One, it goes from 1966 to 1982. That's the dark blue line. And you can see we went through a hump of inflation, a second hump, a big third hump. So inflation, this is the lesson. It comes in waves like this. And these waves take years to burn. Like, they thought it was over here by 1976, 1978. Oh, we've beaten the Hydra. But it grew another head. And so from 1978 to 1980, it took 2 years for that to begin to go up and then peak and come down again. And by the way, that peak there at about 14% inflation, that's why you mentioned we had almost 17% yielding on the 10-year at that point in time, right? So
yes.
So that's why, because you know what? You're going to have to give me 17% because inflation's rising. It's 14%. I need some headroom on that story. So that, I think, at a minimum, looking at this right here, since we're clocking in at about 6% now, long rates are going to have to go up, and they're going to have to go up a lot. And if we follow, and by the way, it's echoing, if not rhyming perfectly, who knows how high we go? My personal prediction is we go higher than in the 1980 hump, because this is an energy shock. That's different. That's going to work its way through the system. We could easily see, in my estimation, 15, 18, 20% inflation in the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to shock everybody. But if you are positioned wrongly in bonds, they will be absolute certificates of confiscation for the capital loss reason you mentioned, and also just the getting paid 5% in a 15% inflationary world. It is a confiscatory moment.
And look, let's say the governments of the world, those that are saying everybody's going to start rearming again, like you've got to, the warfare has changed. OK, so you're going to have to start rearming. You've got the data center spend out that's going. All of this is a huge consumption within commodities. And in the background, governments run these huge deficits. If they're just continuing to print money and yield curve control and all that, I believe that it could be far worse. Corporate profits are at an all-time high. A lot of that has to do with financialization. A lot of that has to do with those commodity prices going down for a long period of time. But that regime has changed. So I do not believe that equities, traditional, your traditional equities that have rewarded people so heavily over the past 10 years, I think emerging markets, commodities, and some of the right places will provide huge opportunity. But for the average person that's caught up in modern portfolio theory, well, it's okay if my bonds are going to go down, stocks are going to make up for it. But if you go back to 1973, when that inflation surged, stocks went down 47% and got to a price earnings ratio of 10. And I can show the chart now, but we've talked about it before. If we get down to a price earnings ratio of 10 and assuming earnings stay the same, that's a 60 to 70% decline in the market. So how horrible is this going to be, especially initially? You know, the assumption is government's just going to print money to get us out of it, but that's going to further exacerbate the inflationary pressures. What's going to happen if people's bonds have been cratered, they're stuck at a lower income, and their equities go back to normal valuations because it squeezes the profits of the corporations? Because if AI is successful like they say it is, heck, nobody's going to have a job to be able to earn money anyway. So it's going to be a pretty tough environment.
Well, to widen the lens a bit, this was so predictable, and I actually talked about this all the way back in 2008 in the crash course, because what this is, Paul, fundamentally, it's fraudulent accounting. It's this idea that you can constantly expand your debt faster than your income or your GDP, and you can just do that forever. And I think we're out of forever. So what it means is that when you have a debt bubble, a credit cycle bubble, they happen. But this is the biggest one ever, and it's infected all of these Western markets we're talking about, and a lot of Eastern ones too. But so when those things break, Paul, it's mathematically impossible for everybody to come out whole. Mm-hmm. Not everybody can't all sell their bonds, you know, and or their stocks. No. And so the point of these things, I heard it said before, the point of a bubble, and that's what we have, a credit bubble, right? And it's many decades in the making. The point of a bubble is to take as much money from as many people as possible. Yeah. Like if it had a point, right? If it had a will, its will is to impoverish the maximum number of people, right?
Yeah.
So what do you need to do to get there? Well, you need everybody fully invested. They have to believe in the story. They have to be, you know, both feet in the pool. They have to just, yeah, all of that. So at any rate, you know, I think the point of this section for me, Paul, is just to warn people, keep your eyes on the bonds, but be clear on what they're telling you. They're telling you that there's been a regime change, and we're going to have to think carefully about how we respond to that.
And the one thing that I want to say to the listeners out there, look, this is pretty scary stuff if you're getting ready to retire and you're out there looking at this. The point is not to terrify people. The point is to share honest and truthful information with you, because if you have the courage to follow the truth wherever it will take you, then you're going to see the inevitable risks that are on the horizon. The good thing about where we are right now is if you are willing to walk the path less traveled, you know the risk that you need to carry, you can prepare yourself and navigate this well. Nobody's going to come through it unscathed, okay? But there are so many asset classes out there that are so ridiculously undervalued right now that they're going to do well out the other, you know, in this regime change environment. It's just not going to be the types of investments that benefited as greatly in the opposite of this trend that are going to benefit as greatly on the other side. So there is opportunity for those that are out there. The thing that I try to warn people about this is passive has its strength and it has its weaknesses. Okay. Passive is probably not going to do as well through this shift is what people think it has, you know, going to do just by looking in the rearview mirror and projecting that in the future. A tactical, adaptive approach is going to be important, right? Do I just go out and ladder all the way out to 30 years across the board? If you have enough money to where you can withstand all of that and you can draw such a low income off of your investments, sure, you're fine. Okay, you're going to lose some soldiers and some other soldiers are going to be okay, but you're not going to get into a situation where you run out of money before you run out of life. Like, the minimum level of success in retirement is the only check that bounces is to the funeral home, right? Because they can't dig you up and take it from you. So there is incredible opportunity for those who are adaptive, have the discipline to control their emotions and walk that path less traveled. Because I think what this market's doing right now, Chris, is you've had people that are perma bulls. The only thing that they're going to see is positive outcome. You have your perma bears. I think your perma bears are on the lower side. And a lot of people will say, oh, you're warning us about it. You know, you're a perma bear. No, I'm not a permanent bear. And you aren't either. You see opportunity. You're warning people about the risks that are out there to try to be a watchman so that they can better be prepared and look at the alternatives. But then you got the people that have been riding the fence. In this market right now, and I believe when you hit peak bubble, is it attempts to force everyone to make a decision. It pulls people off that sideline, right? And you tend to get lopsided in the bullish outcome. And that's just a part of the cycle we go through. Like, you read the Bible front to back. You know, it's like, man, wow, they do good, they get blessed, they do bad, they crash. Another way of saying that is good men create good times. Good times create weak men. They become complacent. They forget the discipline and the fundamentals and the things that you need to do to be successful long term. And then hard times inevitably come. And that's another reason why a lot of times money doesn't make it past the third generation, maybe to the fourth, because they've had different environments they come through. And you get to that third or fourth generation and their identity becomes the money that they have, not the byproduct of the discipline and the work and the path less traveled to accumulate those resources. This is just a part of the cycles we go through, and we happen to be living in a period of time where we're going to have this regime change, fourth turning, whatever you want to call it. I believe we're in the midst of that right now. And it's going to be a challenging environment for a time. And when peak pessimism comes around, is the time where equity valuations are going to be low and probably the maximum opportunity.
I agree. And Paul, I think we're still years away from that because these things just take time to play out.
Yeah.
Right?
They do.
They just will. They just will. All right. Very well said. Thank you for that. Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. Paul, you know what I want to talk about? Oil and gas prices. They're insane. Absolutely
they are.
Insane. So here's a little context. So just a couple days ago, on Monday, because we're recording this on Wednesday, May 20th, so WTI crude, which is just seems to go down, really fights its way back up. But then all of a sudden, Trump comes out and releases this tweet that says, oh, I've decided to hold off on the attacks that were planned for tomorrow, which was Tuesday. And I talked with the leaders of three countries, and I'm respecting their wishes. And he named them, right? Mohammed bin Salman from Saudi Arabia and a couple others. Blah, 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 blah. Turned out none of it was true. right? All the three of those leaders came out to the Wall Street Journal and said, we don't know what he's talking about. We didn't even, yeah. there was an attack planned. We were consulted. So, but this has been a familiar pattern. Trump tweets something and it turns out not to be true, or it's denied. Iran's denying it. In this case, Gulf leaders are denying it. So today, May 20th, here we go again. Trump tweets out, says U.S. is in final stages of talks with Iran. So the 10-year yield falls 10 basis points. Yay! Oil gets absolutely smashed, again, below $100 here in the U.S. Now, I've been on this, Paul, because supply and demand are a thing, and price is the settling mechanism between those two points. So guess what? When you hold prices down, when you tweet smash prices of oil down, you know what happens? You sell more of it. Surprise, right? U.S. oil exports, second biggest on record this last week. The biggest on record was the week prior. So we're exporting this oil. This is oil we don't have. This, all this oil, above this line of about four million barrels a day, everything above this is coming out of our inventories, our strategic petroleum reserve and commercial inventories. Look at this. Most recent record. This is biggest weekly drain on record for the strategic petroleum reserve. We're selling it to the world. Selling it to the world. And now here's where we're just through the looking glass, Orwell spinning in his grave. This is truly insane. Let's try and make sense of this headline together. Oil prices extend decline after the largest crude inventory drawdown in history. And Cushing, Oklahoma's tank bottoms loom. We're only about 5 million barrels away from just being out at Cushing at this point, which is our largest commercial repository. Oil prices extend decline after the largest crude inventory drawdown in history?
So never much for supply and demand.
Have I ever encountered headlines like this? So something is completely fake about this. Something is so fake about this. And by the way, you'll be surprised to learn somebody put a huge bet on oil prices going down just the day before.
Hey, let's get around. Hey, guys, I'm going to tweet tomorrow, so get your trades in. Hey, in that headline, somebody at Zero Hedge has been following the Babylon Bee. Because that's a headline that I would see on the Babylon Bee. And for those of you that aren't familiar, it's all sarcasm. It is absolutely hilarious and shockingly true sometimes. So that's so much for supply and demand, right?
So here's the prediction. You know what we're going to do is we're going to continue to hold prices down because that's politically what needs to happen. Fine. But then what's going to eventually someday, like, we run out or we get too low and we get scared. And all of a sudden, that's when they just slam the lid on the whole thing. Oil prices shoot to the roof. Or if they don't, we run into actual supply issues. So a couple of anecdotes here. One, I had a gentleman drive out from Boston. We worked in the garden together, a Peak follower. Great guy. Good time. Thanks for coming out, Chris. But he said, when I was in Springfield, they had one of those roadside signs lit up that said, no diesel for 60 miles.
Ooh.
So the next two service areas on Route 90, out, just out.
And that's going to further, as they keep moving that sign back, it's going to continue to get consumed more and more. 60 miles.
How do you not have 60 miles of diesel on, this is Route 90, right? This is an interstate highway system.
Yeah,
crazy, right?
This is not South Dakota where it's 120 miles to the next gas station. You've got all kinds of gas stations along the way. Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that, it's just a road sign. Nobody's making anything about it, right? And then the International Energy Agency chief, comes out. And he's warning about commercial oil inventories depleting rapidly, only weeks left. This is the kind of headline that we weren't even close to this level in 2022, when oil effortlessly went up to 120 a barrel, bounced there for several months, and then finally I realized, it wasn't that big of a deal. We sort of resolved what's happening with the whole Russia situation. This is an order of magnitude worse than that, and somehow oil gets smashed because Trump tweets something. Almost every day this is happening now. So a lot of oil traders have decided that there's something afoot in these markets. They're not free. They're not fair. There's an invisible hand. But it's insane, Paul, because whether you agree with politically it makes sense to do this or geopolitically, The point is that when you hold the price down too low, you get too much demand relative to supply. And dwindling oil inventories tell us that we have too much demand relative to supply. There's two ways to deal with this. One, go full communist and just, you know, limit people how much they can buy. Hey, Paul, good news. Diesel's only $5 a gallon. Bad news, you're only allowed to buy it once a month on a Tuesday after 4 o'clock, if there's any, right?
You know, welcome to your forced 15-minute city, right? You can't travel outside of 15 minutes. So.
Exactly. Way number two, which is the time-honored way, is you let price be the settling mechanism, and the price rises until enough demand is destroyed that, you know, it meets supply. And that's honestly the right way to do it because, you know, there are flights that aren't necessary for people to take. There are shipments of super low-value goods that don't necessarily have to happen for our society to function. You know, and those are the things to get trimmed off first, right? You know, we're not doing that. We're going to continue to allow supply to be exceeded by demand until we run into trouble. That's really going to be, ooh, that's going to be painful.
It's going to be painful. Chris, do you know where all of these exports are going? Is a lot of it ending up in Asia and China? Is that where a lot of these are going? Do you have any data on that?
We do. So last week, 7 million barrels total got contracted for, shipped out, and that went all to Asia. And prior to that, we had a load that went to Pakistan. A bunch is going to Europe. So right now, our refineries are busy. You can tune your output a little bit. Like, you can't just say, I want this barrel of oil to become 100% diesel or jet fuel. But you could take the percentages and get a slightly higher cut of something. And so they've tuned it to get a much higher cut of jet fuel because they need that very badly in Europe. So, but because of that, you get a little bit less gasoline and diesel, which are on the other side of that cut. So you know, you get a little more of this, but a little less of that. So right now, the gasoline inventories in the United States have never been lower at this time of the year. And what do we have coming up? Memorial Day. We're kicking off the summer driving season. This is typically when gasoline demand peaks to its highest for June, July, August, right? Maybe even more so now that people like me no longer like flying. I hate it, and I'm not going to Europe. So, you know, I think more people are going to be taking driving vacations than, you know, flying vacations. So we could run into real gas problems. And of course, we know it's a serious problem because Chris Wright, the energy secretary, came out yesterday and said, we're not going to run out of gasoline, which made a lot of people worry we're about to run out of gasoline.
Very good reaction to that statement. You know, but I keep thinking, you keep seeing these charts of China treasuries are continuing to reduce. And I've been looking at Chinese inventories. I've not looked at it in the past week, but they've not hit their strategic reserves where we're drawing ours down. So if I'm them, this is a brilliant opportunity to protect my stockpile, sell these treasuries, buy these oil that appears to be artificially lower in price and pull them over here to let your, what is it, Sun Tzu? I don't know all of the sayings, but don't interrupt your enemy when they're doing something foolish. That's the summary kind of what it is. Chris will remember, y'all. Can you remember exactly what it is, Chris? I'm going to be surprised if you don't.
Never interrupt an enemy who's in the process of making a mistake.
Bingo. Somebody was teasing me the other day. I need to put quotes everywhere. I said, why do I need to do that? Chris always remembers. I just need to get close. So, but you know, if I'm them, I'm going to strip away, let us make a mistake and get our inventories low. And then when I absolutely have to, I've maximized the liquidation of my treasuries. But maybe part of that's why it's going up. I don't have to recycle back in, let rates go up because they've recycled them back into our treasuries. And then you can call, you know, facilitate an economic calamity within the United States. And if it's bad enough, now I've got all these reserves over here that I'll start using to protect our citizenry. Like, it's just brilliant on their part. They're thinking long, assuming that's what they're doing. They're thinking long term, but we're incentivizing that, right? I mean, you see the statistics on the silver that's gone over to China and to India and the other places. And what was it, a year ago we talked about maybe? where the Indian banking system had allowed extra leverage on silver backing, which was like 10 to 1 within certain parameters in relation to gold. And I think we talked about at the time, what that's doing is incentivizing stripping those metals out of the West over to the East. And what our actions are doing is incentivizing stripping our reserves and our emergency fund as a nation over there while they're preserving theirs.
Top three exports, top last 3 months, top exports, gold. It's our top export. And we're exporting a lot of oil, but we're exporting more gold. Where is it going? China. Guaranteed. Yeah. Guaranteed.
And but unobtainium to come back.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a one-way trip for sure. So on the one hand, we got Trump tweeting, which just somehow magically corresponds with all these oil slams. I have my suspicions about how that, the mechanism behind that. But on the other hand, right, we have the IEA chief, Fatih Birol, who I put up here, right? You've got Jeff Currie, the legendary commodities investor out of the Carlyle Group, saying the same thing. Like, this is kind of, he's out there saying flat out, we could hit tank bottoms by July 4th. You know, tank bottoms. That means you've hit operational insufficiency and the refineries just shut down. And now you're in a true crisis that's almost unimaginable to anybody listening, including me. And you've got, Daniel Yergin, the oil guru, was just on CNBC yesterday saying, this looks really bad. So you have all these experts, CEOs of oil companies, top commodity analysts, every major commodities analyst house, all saying the same thing. This is bad. It's heading to worse. And if it gets to worse, this is a real existential moment. Like, this could be really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, all that happens in our markets day after day are these slams, just slams, slam. Look at that, 4.75% at the time I took the snapshot at 11 whatever this morning. It's just, it's relentless. Sell oil, sell oil. And we are selling oils, going to the rest of the world. And we're draining we're eating our seed corn. This is like, Paul, a trust fund kid comes up to you and says, good news, my parents left me a tasty trust fund. I'm going to live off it forever. And you take a peek and you find out they've been eating into the principal balance every month on a heavy basis. And you're like, I have some bad news, kid, you know?
Yeah, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. Yeah, you don't need to be going buying all these depreciating assets just to make yourself look good in front of people that you don't necessarily like. Right.
Yeah, exactly. So while you were gone last week, I also put out this big piece. It was kicked off by watching this astonishing interview between Tucker Carlson and Kevin O'Leary, the Shark Tank guy, wearing a baseball hat, you know, in a suit, in his usual inimical self, talking about this massive data center that they're going to be building in Utah, right? 9 gigawatts. It's going to potentially raise nighttime temperatures by like 26 degrees Fahrenheit because of all the waste heat. I call them giant toasters, right? They're toasters that don't make toast. That's what a data center is. You know, we feed all this energy in, and it makes waste heat, and that has to go somewhere because that's a law of nature. And so it basically gets dumped into the environment. So there could be that, but it was the power. Where's all this power going to come from? He's like, oh, we're going to use, there's this natural gas pipeline, the Ruby pipeline. It's only 17% utilized. We'll just use that in a typical sort of Wall Street, Silicon Valley, like shrug. Oh, the minions will figure that out. I've decided that we need this power. It'll come from somewhere. They like no grounding in reality. So I added the numbers up. I'm like, where's all this? Is anybody mathing the math on natural gas? And so this just came out on Jack Prendelli's status this morning. U.S. gas demand growth by sector. These are 5-year increments in here. 2007 to 13, 13 to 19, 19 to 25. And now we're looking at 2025 to 2031. This is going to be the forecast. Obviously, we haven't made a 2031 yet. But this is going to be the highest growth in gas demand in any 5-year period in history. And it's going to be 27 billion cubic feet per day. Almost the biggest chunk in red LNG feed gas for making liquefied natural gas. Power is just going to be sucking up another 5-6 BCF. Yeah, you've got this industrial here in blue, green. Mexico exports, they're going to need a little more. Canada exports, kind of weird. Canada's usually a net positive. But at any rate, massive. Where's all that going to come from? Where's all that, the largest projected? You know where it's going to come from, Paul? I can tell you exactly where it's going to come from. It is going to come from The customers out there who have the least viable contracted arrangements are going to find themselves in curtailment in moments of need. Now, I picked up some of that language from this amazing comment that somebody just put on Twitter. Great, immediate follow for this guy. It's like, doom. He talked exactly. He said, here's what happens. It's a very complicated market. There are all these different contracts that are out there, right? So different people have different contracts. And the people who have the least contractual teeth or claim get cut off first. It's almost always residential. Those people are at the weakest end of this thing.
Yeah, so they have.
Curtailment just means viciously higher prices, right, for residential.
Or no access at all. What was it? I read a report and or saw an X post that apparently there was some Nevada company that was supplying power over the state line into California, which is going to be potentially redirected or no contract because of the data center that's potentially coming up. So it's like, forget you, people. We're going after the biggest pockets, and we're going to go to them because then we can deal with one customer instead of 20. Like, it's the Walmart model that just absolutely destroyed mom and pop businesses and small communities across the nation, but in our energy capabilities. I mean,
yeah,
horrible.
It just looks to me like we're a little short on people at that sort of Kevin O'Leary level, a little short on people there who've actually swung a hammer, you know, dug a ditch, like played with gravity or been out in reality. This is just the energy reality. The amount of energy ignorance out there is astonishing to me, including to the president, who just couple weeks ago, we talked about this. He's like, oh, we're going to double our oil output next year. I'm like, what? Yeah. No, we're not. not happening, right? So just astonishing that you can have that energy ignorance at all levels. It's profound. It's going to... Now, again, there's opportunity. I want people to be aware, like, your utility costs are going up. Sorry, they just are, right? Electricity's already been going up for a lot of reasons, data center costs being one, but... other reasons, like we forgot to invest in our electrical grid for a couple decades. Oops. But on the other side of that, it's pretty clear to me what the investment thesis is around this, which means the energy sector, particularly in the United States, I think is going to be doing particularly well for a good long time going forward. And that's just the math of it. Barring something crazy, like they nationalize our oil and gas industry or forbid exports and force companies to sell at some prevailing rate the government has set, not what the market would set. You know, those could be disasters. But that's how you wreck a country and you wreck an industry and you wreck the bottom layer of prosperity. And if we do that, what do you think about Costa Rica?
No, I love Costa Rica, by the way. I do. I wish my wife liked it as much as I do, but I love Costa Rica. But yeah, I mean, that's dancing around the edges, but essentially it's full-on communism is what it is, and controlling no free markets and mass misery for all.
Yeah. Yep. So that's the energy story. Obviously, we'll keep tracking that as time goes on, but... oof, what a story developing there. It's amazing. Yeah,
it really is. And that's like one of the reasons why we had developed us. It took a little longer than I wanted to, but building an energy stock strategy to participate in an obvious long-term trend that's adaptable enough to shift as that, you know, rolls through the system till we catch back up. And, you know, it's one of those things where you just have to look at it and say, look, we need some exposure to this from a long-term standpoint. Carry a little bit more risk. A small percentage of your portfolio can make a dramatic outcome, make a huge impact on your inflation protection from that standpoint, assuming that the weight of the evidence seems to be clear. Probably going to take longer than we think, or maybe quicker. Who knows how it is, but the weight of the evidence is there, and you just have to have exposure to it. You look at the cap weighting of the S&P 500. I mean, energy and anything from that standpoint is just minimal a percentage of the S&P allocation. And I think we're going to see a massive regime shift going forward unless there's just absolute communistic type control within there. And but there's going to be plenty of gains there before that heavy hand steps in. So I still see huge opportunity in that space.
Markets are facing heightened uncertainty. and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions. All right, Paul, see that history of bubbles over your head?
Oh, yeah.
It's time to talk about our favorite subject, expensive stocks. And the KOSPI, which is the Korean Stock Exchange. Remember we put this one up? Like, what? That was then. This is now. It's fallen about 10% from its all-time high. So that happens. And again, this is a very condensed little chart here. It's only 5 days old, 5 days long, or 6 days, or whatever. So it's really just a little bump at the top here. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But that's how these things tend to go. They tend to just absolutely verticalize and then come right back down again. So not saying it's all the way over, but this is the kind of rumblings you see at the ends of these big blow-offs. So maybe keep an eye on the KOSPI. South Korea is sort of a leading indicator, maybe, as to how bubbles end. But this is the S&P 500 versus M2, so dividing it by M2, the broad money, most overvalued since the 2000.com bubble. Yikes. Yeah. Most overvalued. And this comes at a time when people have the highest level of margin debt. So margin debt is when people are borrowing typically to go long the stock market. I suppose you could borrow to go short too, but for the most part, margin debt is for going long. So they're really levered up, and global markets investor writes, holy cow, spiked $83 billion in April. Paul, $83 billion of new borrowing in 1 month to throw into the stock market. $1.3 trillion in there. Leverage borrowing.
Risk assets.
Yeah. Leverage borrowing has soared $453 billion or 53% over the past year. Margin debt, now 5.2% of U.S. GDP, also an all-time record. What could go wrong?
Yeah, we're in record territory. I mean, just records are being broken all over the place. And I've got a couple other, you know, valuation measures. Let me see if I can get to the right ones here. That's just absolutely mind-boggling as to where we are. And this is just warnings, right? This is not a prediction of where we are. So the thing we have to take into consideration is the 2000 bubble, the technology bubble. We say 2000 happened before that. That shattered the records of the Great Depression. Okay. So the question is, are we going to shatter even those records before this is over? There's no way of knowing, but you take William Middlecoat put this together. So this is good because I like looking at the average of the four valuation indicators. So you look at this and, you know, we peaked 181%, we're 172. Look in the context of history going all the way back to 1900. 74% led to the Great Depression. Okay. We shattered it really at 124% in the year 2000. And we have since shattered it here. Okay. So
wow.
I mean, that's just massive from that standpoint. And I've shown this before, so you guys just bear with me because this is hard to you know, the right side when I highlight it goes over to the left side. But this is the aggregate market value index by companies that's just put this together. So they put an aggregation of them together.
Look at that, like their gas gauge up there or whatever.
I know
the meter.
It looks at the,
Yeah, it's pegged.
Like this is absolutely pegged. Right. I grew up riding dirt bikes and, you know, cars back then. They didn't have throttle regulators and all that. So, you know, you had tons of friends that were revving their motors to max RPMs and would blow the engine up. I mean, that we're in that type territory. So we've broken the 2000 top. Now, this one only goes back to 1968. But if you go back to the 2000 top, if I can hit it here, that's June 30th of 2000. The AMVI model score was 1.69, two standard deviations of strongly overvalued. On the left, and if I move my mouse here, then I'm going to lose that spot. Mm-hmm. The actual following subsequent 10-year return for the S&P 500 was a negative 29% loss. Oh. Even with all of the money printing and slamming interest rates to zero. So you go back to 2008, we were only one standard deviation. So if I can hit that, that's August 31st of 2007. With all the money printing, you actually had a 68% return, which is 6.8% a year over 10 years. Go back to the 1960s, leading into the high inflation of the late 1970s, you had a negative following 10-year return from November 30th, 1968 of a negative 13. So the question is, is it different this time? We might go a lot higher before it's over, but you know, this is just mathematics. The likelihood of the S&P generating the returns over the next 10 years that it has over the past 10 years is highly unlikely. Because look, I mean, if you go back to 2010, you were actually undervalued on the S&P, and the following 10-year return on the left was 179%. So I mean, we're in the type territory where bad things really, really happen. I mean, we're there. The question is, and what's so hard for investors, is the discipline to keep your emotions in check while this market's forcing people off the sidelines, right? There's going to be people, unfortunately, out there that have been sitting in cash for 10 years and they can't take it anymore. And they're going to pile in. And will it be at the worst time? I mean, a legendary investor, Stan Druckenmiller, shares the mistake that he made back in the year 2000 when he finally couldn't take it anymore. And he kind of went all in and happened to top tick the market. And the interviewer asked him, says, what was the lesson you learned? He's like, I did learn a lesson. I knew I shouldn't have done it anyway. I just couldn't keep my emotions in check. Yeah. That's one thing I like about him. He's honest about that. So, you know, if a legend in the industry like Stan Druckenmiller can get sucked off the sidelines at this point, then any of us can. And that's where we have to be disciplined. We have to follow our strategy and keep our emotions in check. You have to feel the fear and do the right thing anyway. Because those emotions are going to be there, but you can't let them control your decisions, because if we give in to this fear of missing out, we're going to justify through confirmation bias that we're going to be right. And hey, I can share some charts here in a minute or whenever it's appropriate. You might feel really good for a year, but there's no way to get out of this without emotional pain. Because if you're prudent in a foolish environment, you're going to feel emotional pain. You might feel the joy on the front side if you're participating, but you're going to have the emotional pain on the other side when we revert back to the mean. And Paul, yes.
What if this time is different?
Well, it could be.
Well, let me make the devil's advocate case. Okay. We all know, and we've all been conditioned and habituated, the Fed's going to print.
Yes.
Right? They're going to print. So printing seems to cure all ills. Now, on the other side of this, this is an energy shock, and some central bankers are starting to notice you can't print your way through an energy shock. It's a different beast, but we'll try anyway, right? So that could be a case for why prices might go up full speed ahead, damn the torpedoes. But the other thing that's really different this time, we've never had a president who's day trading the stock market, and we've never had the government wading communist style into taking ownership pieces in our public companies. The U.S. government has interest stakes now in Intel. It has an interest stake in NVIDIA. Who knows what else they've done? Because of FASAB 56, national security, got to hide the account and stuff. We don't know. I'm going to guess it's not zero. So how do we, I mean, I love using the past as a guide, but, you know, in that the 63 and the, even the 2000 things, the Fed didn't print, like, now they just print, like, ever since 2008. We watched them print And it wasn't just this big blob with the TARP and the TELF and all those acronyms to get us out of 09 up into 10. They printed all through 2011, 12, 13, 14, 15.
Absolutely.
16. Held a little steady for a while. Tried to back it off in 2019. Oops, repo crisis. Printed. COVID. Whoa. I don't know. You know, I can, I'm sympathetic to the idea that people could look at that and say, well, that's what's going to happen again.
No, and I am sympathetic to that too. But still, if they continue to do that, history shows us that you're going to end up in a currency crisis, right? Because the world is becoming smaller. We've seen the East has prepared themselves a lot better. They've talked about the unit. They've got their own alternative to the SWIFT banking system. So there are positioning that's taken a place. So maybe it's absolutely different, right? So you go back to Germany leading up to the end of the war. They made it you couldn't sell anytime the market was going down, and the market went up. It was artificially controlled. And then as soon as the war was over and they finished and they went back to an honest market, it dropped 90%. And the people that were in couldn't get out. So, you know, yeah, it may be absolutely different this time. You can't rule that out because we printed, but the consequences are going to rebalance somewhere. It's either a currency crisis. But if it is different this time and you start to see commodities take off and you start to see emerging markets, we're seeing some of that now. What will be different is how to maintain your purchasing power through, right? We may not have a 50 or 60 or 70% stock market decline, but you may see that leadership change. And I believe that a lot of times if you're seeking wisdom, you're going to, let me see if I can find it here because I want to pull this up because it's a really good chart. If you're seeking wisdom, you see types and shadows and warnings. So you're going to see some adaptation that allows you to make that move that is prudent and wise. So where I think, even if the markets don't go down, what will still be different is what are the assets leading in the next, you know, 10 years that are going to protect your purchasing power better than anything else. So this is where we are, right? So what I'm sharing here is a chart of the major indexes going back to January 1st, 2008. So you've got the S&P 500 index here in black. That's been really the only game in town since about 2014. It wasn't till maybe 21 that you started seeing developed and emerging markets take off. That's really been recently since about 2023. But you can see commodities, I mean, they've just up 21%. The Goldman Sachs Commodity Index is only up 21% since 2008. So what are we, 16, 18 years now? Okay. Mm-hmm. So if they do print us into oblivion, what have we seen? We've seen a birth pain, a breakout, wheat's up, cattle's up, you know, sulfur's up, all of this. Yes, it's an energy shock, but the inflationary pressures are there. Now, the chart doesn't go the full period of time, but if you go back to 1990 to 2000, what happened? That bubble sucked all of the money into the U.S. So this data, it cost me a bunch of money to go back to 1990, so I haven't spent the money to do it, but it does represent the point that U.S. equities outperformed everything else. I mean, if you look at just commodities from 1995 to the year 2000, December 31st, 1999, they were only up 5%. What happened on the other side of that? Okay, on the other side of that, government slamming rates to zero, markets came off. Where did the opportunity shift to? So from 2000, so this is a chart of those same major indexes from 2000, December 31st, 2007. Emerging markets were up around 213. Goldman Commodity Index was up about 213, well, 210 and 213. And even international developed markets were up 109 versus U.S. going flat. So, I, you know, my argument is that mathematics still matter and financialization matters, and it reaches the point to where something breaks, okay? And that may not be a 50 or 60% decline in the U.S. equity market. That's what's happened historically in these places. But let's say they print. Well, the bond market's going to have some issues unless they artificially control it. Well, if it's in the bond market and then they're artificially continuing to prop the stock market, they're going to have to buy commodities and we're underinvested. And that's just more money that's rolling through the system that's going to find the most undervalued, most efficient place to be when that regime changes. And I mean, even going back here, you know, we were in a weaker dollar environment really till about 2010. So if you go back through the crisis in 08, the S&P 500 from 2000 to year end 2010 was down 14%. Commodities, in spite of that massive decline that occurred in the credit crisis in 2008, were up 227 and 212. So, you know, yeah, it could be different this time, but from my standpoint, I'm not so worried if it's different, because we're going to make the adaptation to the most efficient place that has the most amount of money flow and momentum and trend that's with it to try to protect that purchasing power going forward.
So they say every bubble's in search of a pin, you know. The thing that's caught my attention, of course, is the behavior of bonds. So big moving pieces. A, we have a regime change, interest rates all on their own before the war even was thinking about getting started. Decided to start going the other direction. After 40 years of going down, they've broke that trend, off they go. So that's big, big moment number one. Pay attention. Two, we have this war that kicked off. This is the largest energy shock in history. It's not yet priced in the markets for reasons, who knows why. But maybe markets have just, here's the most generous explanation I can come up with. Markets have been so trained on liquidity being the one and only measure of truth and value and reality that they just literally are incapable of properly pricing this energy shock until it's going to be forced to, which will be kind of a terrible moment. Three, we also have a U.S. government that's now completely committed, independent of administration, but completely committed to deficit spending. It's structural, right? The CBO, Congressional Budget Office, says, based on laws that are already on the books, we're going to be running around $2 to $3 trillion of deficit every year for the next 10 years, right? Ooh, another 20, 30 trillion of debt that's going to be piling on. Guess what? The war was expensive. It's going to be a little hotter than that this year. Maybe next year. Who knows how much longer, right? And then against all of that, the United States is seemingly not adding up the macro numbers on energy. Energy is the lifeblood of your economy. That's where all prosperity comes from. Cheap, abundant energy in particular, okay? We're busy just selling that to anybody. I don't understand this, Paul. I don't understand. So I don't have any grandkids, but eventually I hope I will. And when they get, you know, to be adults, they're going to go, what'd you guys do with all that natural gas? We would love to have some natural gas to do things with.
Yeah.
You did what with it? Oh, well, see, we turned it into liquid natural gas and we put it in a tanker and we sold it to Europe. Like, they're like, yeah, but Europeans, they hate us. So we sold, okay, we sold. What was so important? Why did we sell it to them? Well, because we got money back. Wait, you mean that stuff you just printed out of thin air? You mean not actual money, you mean currency, ones and zeros on hard disks that represented money? So let me get this straight. You took our once-in-a-species bequeathment of this most amazing molecule that you can do almost anything with, and you liquefied it and sold it to some people who don't even like you for money? It's such a nonsense story. It really is.
Yeah.
You know?
It's unfortunately short-term instant gratification thinking, no long-term strategic planning. And that's just what happens when you get into a society where things have been so good. People forget that it takes discipline and sacrifice and planning and a little bit of pain for the future, right? Like, our economy is operating like we're eating cake every day. Like, I mean, how do we think of a parent that, you know, as soon as a child starts to eat solid food, feeds them cake for breakfast, lunch, and M&Ms for dinner, right? I mean, we know that's not good long term, but boy, that kid really likes you, right? Because you're giving them all these great things instead of, hey, you got to eat your carrots and you got to eat. Discipline still matters from a long term standpoint. And there are periods of time. I mean, that right there just illustrates it. You know, yeah, the bubbles are getting a little bit bigger because of all the money that's been printed from a fiat standpoint. But there's a reason why that you know, gold has been the one thing that's been the standard throughout history for monetary, because there are limits, right? You get these manias. If you don't have enough gold, then you get the inflation, then you get the deflation on the other side. So it's a counterbalancing mechanism. And we've detached from the counterbalancing mechanism in the 1970s. But there's other countries that see value in that at this point. So it may be different for longer than we could possibly imagine. But But at least at this point, we don't control the whole world, right? I mean, if there was a viable alternative, if the government continues to print and there's a currency that, you know, let's say China comes out and says, hey, you can buy a 20-year treasury from us. It's going to be backed by gold and you can take your dividends and you can swap it out for gold 20 years from now. Hey, that's something I'm interested in, because if we get printed into oblivion, there's a good chance that gold's going to continue to maintain its purchasing power. So that's kind of my standpoint. There's too many forces that they might can control things here, but there are other countries that are going to say, we're not participating in that anymore. And the pain of changing and walking away from that system will be easier than the pain of staying the same. And if it is truly different this time, it's just going to last longer, I believe, because at some point the pain of changing is going to be easier than the pain of staying the same. And I believe that that changing mechanism is going to be inflation.
Yeah. And while that inflation is on the way, then there's that pig is already in the python. It could get worse. We could do things to make it worse. But and I believe our energy policies are trying hard. We'll see. But, you know, if we diplomatically ruin things with our main trading partners for whatever reason, that could make it worse. If we print more money, you know. So the thing that bothers me about this, sort of from a moral standpoint, right? So again, I care about my kids a lot. I care about your kids. I care about the next generation. I've reached that level of my life in wisdom. And I don't need more trinkets and baubles. You know, I've achieved everything I'm meant to achieve from a material standpoint. And so I look at this, and I know the Fed is just desperate to always make stocks go up and to the right, you know? But they keep them at these historically highly elevated levels, and they have reasons for that, Paul. Like, oh, think of the bad things that would happen if the market had to correct and find a natural price, right? Well, what would happen is my kids and your kids and other kids would be able to buy into the stock market at a fair price and get the same shot at life that I had.
Right. Right?
But they're not, and they want just the old guard. You know, the average age of somebody in Congress now is like 70 plus. They're all boomers, and they don't want it. They just want it to be how it's good for them. Mm-hmm. And I'm starting to get a real bad taste in my mouth about people who are just narcissistic. It's all about them. They just want the markets to do what's good for them, and they don't care about anybody else, including their own offspring, which tells me you have a damaged human being on your hands.
Right.
Like, if you can't even care about your own offspring at that level, you're a broken person. Sorry.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I just think, you know, we should let nature take its course. If things are overextended, need to fall back, like what's over your head there, then that's what happens. It's painful. Guess what? We'll pick ourselves up and keep going. But with a better life for the people who are in the best position at the start of their life to make the most out of it. Yeah.
Right.
Making this all sort of hold together so people's retirement dreams aren't sullied a bit. It's just, I don't know.
You know, you look at the statistics, okay? You see how many of these professional athletes, these high income earners, the actors, they've had massive amounts of wealth, you know, the drug addiction, everything that goes in there, right? Now, some of them built their career, but especially when you get into what we would classify as kind of trust fund babies, right? They're not as happy as the average individual. Now, the person who gives it to them, they're happy because, look, you don't ever have to work because I've paid the sacrifice for you. You'll thank me for the next couple of generations, but you're essentially robbing them of the journey. The money that comes from making an impact in society and blessing other people is a byproduct of doing something with your life, right? And there's real joy that comes along with that, is the journey and the sacrifice and learning and coming through, and then you can be a blessing to others. So, you know, we get into that position where for whatever reason, there's such a focus on us of the leaders that are there and that narcissism that you're talking about. It's like, hey, we're just going to fix things for you and it'll be easy. But you're actually robbing that next generation of building resiliency and confidence that, you know, look, if we have an economic calamity and I lose everything, I've done everything right, but I still lose everything. You know what? You can drop me and I can rebuild it again because I have the skill set and the discipline and the fortitude and the work ethic and the grit to fight through the other side. And those individuals are far more secure than the group of individuals that needs the government to bail them out because they're living a lifestyle that they really can't afford to live. And they're living right by that edge, and they're going to vote, please bail me out, because if you don't, I have to give up my life as it is, and the things that I have are who I am instead of a byproduct of who I am.
Well, and on that front, probably half my conversations these past few months, I did a big Renaissance report on AI. You know, what is it? All this probably already hopelessly out of date, right? Because every day I wake up and I'm like, this is changing too fast. Like, look at this new thing. It does. Like, now we're having honest conversations. Like, is this sentient? Like, how would I know? But the point is that, you know, I was just talking with my youngest child, and she's having trouble finding a job because the area she wants to go into, wouldn't you know it, there's a lot of people with decades of experience above her who just got booted from their jobs. And so now she's in competition in a hyper tight job market because AI has already taken that. So we're not even having the conversation, which is, if we define our meaning and purpose by how we apply ourselves in the world, but then we take our opportunities to apply ourselves in the world away, and we're not going to talk about that, and we're not going to offer anything other than, I don't know, buck up and work hard like I did. Different environment, 40 years of tailwind on, you know, there was no AI. So again, we're doing something to our next generation here that I can't brook it. It's unconscionable, right? Oh, we're just going to build all these data centers as fast as we can because we need AI. And, you know, some people are going to lose jobs. Like, whoa, it's existential. If they're not going to have jobs, what are they going to do?
And that's weak men bringing about hard times. And I mean, unfortunately, it seems that we're heading in that direction because the focus is on, I want to be the richest person in the world, or I want to join this X amount of club, and I want to accomplish this, and I want to bring about a sentient AI or whatever it is. It's I instead of what is best for everybody. And that goes back to that scripture, you know. The Bible says something along the lines of, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. When I first got in the industry, I thought that was money. And money is a byproduct of that. Mm-hmm. But I believe now that it's character, discipline, a good reputation, a good name, the individual that stands up for what is right, regardless of the consequences. Because think about what the forefathers of us in our country did. I mean, they put all of their wealth on the line and their lives on the line for this idea that was America, so that their children can have something better than what they left. And we're just not in that mentality now. It's like, we want to do what's best for me, and the rest of the generations can fend for themselves. And that's going to leave behind a generation that is not going to want to stack the pain on top of their children as what was left to them. And so, you know, I don't think the history books are gonna judge the mentality and the selfishness that we've had during this period of time very good. It's going to be an example of what not to do in the future.
Yeah, I agree. I read a piece probably over a decade ago where Warren Buffett penned a little essay, and the title of it was Squanderville. And he just said, wow, we were just squandering our opportunities here. And that was a key conclusion I came to in the crash course independently, which was, look, we have some tough decisions we have to make today, but if we don't make them, kick the can, they become much harder decisions downstream. So right now, it'll be tough if we let our oil markets adjust to real pricing. It'll be a little bit painful. But if we wait until we crash into the wall and we don't have any oil left to do anything with, realistically, your option set gets a lot smaller and a lot more painful. And that's just the nature of it. You can ignore some things, but not forever. And that's what I feel like we've been doing. That's the squandering of opportunity cost of time. We're just squandering. We're just squandering right. It. You right. Did what? You built data centers? You know, you can just hear it coming in for the future, looking back like, yeah, we're going to file that next to facing large stone heads east. With, you know, well, after cutting down the last of your trees, okay? You know, we'll file it under that part of human behavior, you know?
Yeah, well said. Very well said.
Good. All right. Well, with that, Paul, we are done for today. So if anybody out there listening wants to talk to Paul or his amazing team, please go to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a simple form, a few questions in there, and some disclosures and click send or submit. And then somebody from Paul's office will be in touch with you within 48 business hours to schedule what will be the first of three calls. You get an introductory call, then a planning call, and then finally, if you get there, a recommendations call. And if all of that sort of sorts itself out and it makes sense to work together, then you could go down that part of the road with Paul. Everybody who's gone down that process, though, independent of whether or not they end up working with Paul and his team, says it's been a highly valuable process. So I would encourage you to take advantage of that today while you can.
And thank you for that. Like, it's so refreshing because what I'm able to show people, especially when they go through the planning process, is where you are. And the feedback I get consistently, even with the people, I'm like, hey, guys, it's not appropriate for us to work together, but have you gotten some benefit out of this? And they're like, absolutely. My emotions, I'm not as scared as I was before. Or, well, you kind of confirmed that you know, I'd been told that I was in good shape and I'm not quite as good a shape as what I was being, but I know what I need to do. There's a lot of peace of mind of knowing where you are, what the risks are to your success, and the things that you can do to maximize your probabilities in an unknown future. So to me, that's just such a blessing. It never gets old. Somebody asked me, they're like, do you ever get tired of running these plans? I'm like, no, because every single person's situation is different. Their goals are different. Their desires are different. Their assets are different. And I'm able to take that to help educate people on, hey, these are the things that you need to shore up. These are the things that you're in good shape on. And then if we go to a recommendation, obviously we give recommendations on that. So it's such an honor for myself, John Alexander, Dylan Smith, and Alex Snellgrove now is doing that as well. So, you know, no obligation. I hope you guys can tell we're not high pressure. If we can help you and all that is the plan, then everything else will take care of itself.
Well, thank you for doing that, Paul, and thanks for your time again today.
You're welcome. Good to see you, Chris.
All right. Bye, everybody. We'll be back next week with another episode of Finance U.